this. And then John and Makisha have a little one who is ill right now, and Tecumseh just had some dental surgery yesterday, and we have some other folks as well like that. Randy Blackburn has a sister. They found a spot of bone cancer with her just within the last few days, and they have the latest tests are that it is very localized in one place, and they believe they'll be able to deal with it, and so remember her. And then Randy's daughter Erica is going to have another surgery in the vertebrae here, so be praying for Erica. We have some other things that are happening. Of course, this weekend we have a good many people who will be traveling here and there, perhaps even some of you. Help us watch out for our guests who will be here. And we do have also several activities. Tomorrow and Friday, for example, some of our folks are helping Brother Lonnie do the estate sale that was mentioned here the last time or two we've met, so be aware of that. And we're finishing tonight really a little bit of our reflection on the series that we got to think through together this summer, the I Am statements of Jesus from the Gospel of John and the Book of Revelation. And we don't usually, I mean, we hear the I Ams, and we form opinions about, or maybe impressions about what those things mean. And normally if we think of consequences, we're thinking of the sort of the bad type of response. But there are positive consequences too. Of responding to the claims of Jesus with belief. For example, I want to ask you to consider for a moment, what have been the consequences in your life of your believing these claims made by Jesus that we've heard this summer? Normally, I take it for granted that having people present on Wednesday evening means they do believe these claims, and that would be one consequence. Think of the differences in your use of time that have occurred because you believe these claims of Jesus. You could be ensconced at home in front of a cable news program right now, being really, really encouraged, couldn't you? Or you could be watching the pregame of a show of a ball game, and just think of that would be a repeat performance, maybe the way you used last night or something. What are some of the consequences of believing in your life? Are there any of them you'd like to say out loud? And it's okay, David? All right. What Eddie mentioned about the teaching of the children and having children who honor their parents and who are of good character and who are serving to be a blessing to other people in the world. Yeah. 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 I'm looking at the positive consequences right now. There are consequences of unbelief, which we studied last week. I tried to. What are some of the other consequences of believing in your life that you can think of, Bill?
1939.
A little bit, yes.
Sure. guess what? Here I am.
And I'm thankful you made that first visit. Bill went to church the first time with his partner before Eddie started the kindergarten. All right. What else can you think of? And by the way, you think of how Bill has blessed all of our lives over the years because of that first visit, and you apparently have taken some claims to heart there. Can you think of other ways, other consequences in your life because you believe? Jim? All right. I wish the drawback of trying to do this in a big room is not everybody can hear. I wish I had a microphone, everybody. But Bill just mentioned, or Jim just mentioned, three things. One is some sense of direction and how to live. Second is assurance of forgiveness and cleansing when he knows that he's fallen short. And third is the hope that goes along with that. They're all three of those things. Anybody else? All right. You're only allowed one consequence, though. I'm kidding, Dave. Go ahead. Okay. All right. Brothers and sisters in the Lord. Yes. In our case, where we've gone, we've known where to go to find people who would love us. And when our kids have gone to other places and other communities, they've ended up with moms and dads and grandmas and grandpas, 100 of them in those places, just because they were believers in the Lord who went to meet with the Lord's people in those places. And a lot of, if you watch, let me say it this way. If you watch, if you're an observer of society right now and the social issues that are controversial, the problems that go on and get argued over politically in our culture right now, and if you think about this and you stop and watch and you think of what if there were believers in the Lord all around, what would happen to this problem? What if? And you think of it that way, and I think you could see some of what we're getting at. So some of the responses and consequences of belief tonight is what we want to look at. And I'd like to read for you sometime in the as the summer had begun, and after we had already attached the He Is My Everything theme to our summer series, I ran across something I had clipped, I'm sure, years ago. He's everything to me. And by the way, we never did sing that song this summer. I figured we'd sing that several times. We never did. It's in our book. I'd like to read this. This is the impact of the claims of Jesus. He's everything to me. In His life, Christ is an example. In His death, He's a sacrifice. In His resurrection, He's a conqueror. In His ascension, He is a king. In His intercession, He's a high priest. Christ is full and sufficient for all His people. He is bread, wine, milk, living waters to feed them. He's a garment of righteousness to cover and adorn them, a physician to heal them, a counselor to advise them, a captain to defend them, a prince to rule them, a prophet to teach them, a priest to make atonement for them, a husband to love them, a father to provide, a brother to relieve, a foundation to support, a root to give life, a head to guide, a treasurer to enrich, a son to enlighten, and a fountain to cleanse. He's everything to me. Now, what are the anticipated consequences of this conviction? You might think at first sight, if the Lord were a good salesman, if He really wanted to have people decide to be His disciples, and if He really wanted to increase the number of His disciples, then surely He would just tell them, you follow Me, and you'll have it made from now on. That's the way a regular fellow probably would do it if he were in sales. But that's not what the Lord does. In Revelation 2 and 3, we'll use this as a basis for our thinking about the consequences of belief. And what happens in Revelation 2 and 3? What's there? All right, the letters to the seven churches of Asia, Asia Minor, the seven towns in a sort of an irregular circle in the interior of what is now Turkey, and places where the Lord's people are having try to live in the world as it is. And I want to use this to just think with you about a few basic points about belief as a response to the I Am claims of Jesus. And I'm trying to make this as simple as I can, but I believe they're important thoughts. And I invite you to think along. Number one, I don't mean it like a sermon, that's probably how it's going to sound. But we learn here that belief sees in Christ sufficient reason to look at life and to fear not. What are all the possible things you can think of right now that make you afraid? That's an easier list to make than the consequences of belief, isn't it, man? We could check them off. Depending on what point we are in life, the variety would change only a little, but they range all the way from things outside of us in the world of people we don't even know, to things inside of us about what happens to us in our lives or what we get anxious about. In Revelation 1, there's the great vision of the Christ. Not the meek and gentle Jesus living among us, but now the glorified Christ, and He walks in the middle of these candlesticks, which we learn represent these different congregations of His people in these different places. He's clothed like an a, a, a priest or a king or someone of great wealth and honor would be. The hairs of his head are white like wool, like snow, indicating great honor and age and wisdom. His feet are like burnished bronze. They could walk on anything and not be harmed. His voice is like the roar of many waterfalls. And he puts in his right hand, he holds these stars, which turn out to be the angel of these churches. And from his mouth, there's a sharp, two-edged sword, indicating the power of what he says, the authority of what he says. And then his face is like the sun shining at its brightest point in the clearest day. All of that indicates something of an awesome picture, and every part of it adds some element to this. And when John sees him, John says, "Oh, isn't it nice to be in his presence?" Is that right? What does John do? He falls at his feet like one dead. Why? The awe of the Christ that he sees, the power, the majesty, the wonder of him. John just falls down, and the Lord puts his hand on him, and he says, "Fear not. I am," does that sound familiar? "I am the first and the last." We had one of our lessons on parts of this "I am," but you think about that, and why does the Lord reveal himself to John this way in the beginning of this book of Revelation? There are a lot of things you could be afraid of unless you fear him, unless you're convinced that he is greater than all of those things are, all put together. And this is the basic point of belief. I could tell you that his face, you guys look over there, his face is bright as that sun away. And you see what he's talking. The idea is here, belief starts with this conviction. You don't fear the one who'd be able to kill the body. You fear the one whose authority would extend to body and soul. Right? From Matthew 10. In this case, the Lord puts his gentle hand on John and tells him to not be afraid. Now, what happens in chapters 2 and 3 is each of the details of this great picture, of this great vision of the Christ, turn out to be the greetings of these seven letters. His eyes, his feet, his face, his clothing, his hair, his word, that turns out to be the identifying mark of the one who is speaking to his people here. All right, time gets away real quick, so forgive me if I don't spend enough time on that. This is where we start, though. There's something about belief which sees in Christ sufficient reason to fear not. Now, remember just now, the consequences of believing that I asked you about a moment ago. How are you not afraid when your kids go off to live somewhere else? How are you not afraid when you're puzzled about how to live life, or when you know you've stumbled, or when you're facing age and illness, or when the world's messed up? How are you not afraid? You better believe in something that is sufficient, and that's the faith choice that we've made to start with on the basis of the claims of Jesus and the signs which confirm them. That's the idea. Secondly, now, belief lives and lasts within a community of the saints. This is my way of saying it, so you kind of roll over in your mind what I'm getting at here. Faith has to be practiced and developed and matured somewhere. And what I mean by within a community of the saints, who are the saints in the book of Revelation, by the way? They're the Christians and a place. They're people who have been ransomed with the blood of the Lamb, forgiven of their sins, added to His kingdom. Just not special Christians, but just regular faithful Christians or saints. The saints. So a community of the saints would be a congregation, whether it's in Ephesus or Smyrna or Pergamum or Thyatira or Sardis or Philadelphia or Laodicea, a congregation somewhere. And you notice that these letters will say to the angel of the church in such and such, each time, 2:1, 2:8, 2:12, 2:18. So each time to the church, to the angel of the church in some place. The church is a congregation in the place where the people live. And that turns out to be a laboratory where faith thrives. That's about belief. Belief in this next one is very important. Belief realizes that a Christ great enough to sustain His people in whatever place they are must also be a Christ who is so great that His people are accountable to Him. Now think about what I'm getting at. A very common issue where faith matters are concerned is that on a human basis, I suppose, we end up wanting there to be a God who is big enough to take care of us, but not so big that we can't turn Him into what we want Him to be. And you know that that's the human tendency. The word for it is idolatry, of course. So what I'm getting at here is in these letters to the seven churches, the Lord who invites His people to not be afraid is also a Lord who says to His people, I know where you live. I know your works. I have this against you. I will. In other words, He can do things, and He will. And maybe the best single verse in what I'm getting at here is in chapter 2 and verse 23. In the midst of the letter to the church in Thyatira, beginning partway through this verse, he says, "And all the churches will know that I am He who searches mind and heart, and I will give to each of you according to your works." All right, that's what I'm getting at. The belief realizes that. It's not afraid of Him in the sense of I dread Him, but it is afraid of Him in the sense of I don't want to give account to Him for having rejected Him or rebelled against His right to rule in my life. Now, moving a little farther into this would be idea number 4, if you're keeping track. Belief gets tested. It's the, this these letters certainly do not teach. You just follow Jesus, and you're never going to have another problem again. You'll have some problems because you are following Jesus. Belief gets tested through the interaction of human nature. I mean, Christians are still human beings, and they have all the problems the flesh is heir to, as some people say. We have our internal frailties, and we have our physical frailties. But as our human nature reacts to the pressures experienced in a place over a long period of time, belief gets tested. And one unique thing about these letters is they each have their own particular kind of trials that believers in these towns face. In Laodicea, it's you don't have any real problems, things are too easy, you don't really need anything. In Philadelphia, or in Pergamum, or in Smyrna, it's that people are being imprisoned and they're dying only because they believe. So they're different kinds of problems, but I categorize them in three major ways without trying to read all three of the letters. Here they are. There's false religion, whether there's somebody who claims to be an apostle and isn't, or whether there's somebody who is trying to force people to compromise the and worship a Caesar or the god of the local trade guild or whatever it is. There are the different groups, the Nicolaitans, the woman Jezebel in one of the places, who tries to force people to do things that they shouldn't. There's a synagogue of Satan, chapter 3 and verse 9 mentions. And then there's persecuting power. In some of these towns, there were centers of Caesar worship, where you had to burn incense once in a year and to say Caesar is Lord, to make that confession, or you would face the consequences for that. In some of these towns, there were trade guilds to which you had to belong if you were going to make a living. And in order to belong to them, you had to worship each guild's god or goddesses. You had to be loyal to, or you couldn't make a living. And then there is the worldliness that especially involves the practice of sexual immorality and the eating of food sacrificed to idols, perhaps in some of the feasts at the in the places of these trade guilds. So however we phrase it, there are three main types of pressures in these places: false religion, persecuting power, and the temptations of worldliness. Are you familiar with any of those in any form? Okay, you think about that. Now, with these three major types of pressures, there are three major, three main threats. And here's how again, I'm summarizing, yes, these three letters, but here's how I would say it. One is receding love, distance where there was closeness, suspicion where there was welcome, weary selfishness where there was warm interaction among people. And then compromise. Go ahead and say Christ is Lord. It won't hurt you to say Caesar is Lord, too. Go ahead and go to church on Sunday if that's what you need to do. But, you know, do what you need, also what you need to do on Monday at work. Just engage in the in the feast and the behavior with everybody else in order to get along and make a living. And then there's the indifference, the worst case of which is at Laodicea, where everyone thinks, I'm rich, I've prospered, I need nothing, etc. The loss of interest over time. Now, you stop and think about it. Have you, maybe I should say, haven't we all in our Christian lives found these to be challenges to our belief over time? Isn't it easy to draw back from people and to sort of go along to get along and to care a little less about the Lord and what He asks us? And that's easy, isn't it? And that's kind of what, that's the truth about belief. It faces that kind of trial or that kind of testing over time. And speaking of time, we have 6 minutes left, so let me hurry with this. Belief continually corrects and renews itself in relation to and through its object, which in this case is Christ. He's the one in whom we believe. And so every week, first day of the week, believers get together and remember and renew and bring themselves back in line with, attune themselves to Christ instead of to the noise that is heard all around every day. And in these letters, there are these things. His presence, where Jesus says, I know. I walk among the candlesticks. I know. And then his approval, and he will commend in each of these letters, with the exception of two, I think. He commends something that he finds in the church there. And in some cases, it is a wonderful string of things. For example, I like chapter 2 and verse 19. I know your works, your love and faith and service and patient endurance, and that your latter works exceed the first. That's a wonderful commendation. And then his admonitions. He'll say, I have this against you. Here's something that you need. And in two of these letters, he doesn't offer any admonition. They're the two places where it's hardest to be a Christian, by the way. But in all the rest of them, he does. And then he offers some sense of reassurance. And I'll mention this quickly. Belief overcomes through intentional action. And here are some of the words I've picked out from these letters right here. Look at this list. Remember, repent, do, be faithful, hold fast, keep, buy from me what you need. In other words, get from me. And you have to buy it without money. That's a thing. But you do have to get it from the Lord. And so this is the action of overcoming. The things that you decide to do because you see the challenges that you face and the things that need to be done in life. And then belief endures in the interest of things hoped for by the conviction of things not seen. Where did I get the last part of that statement? Hebrews 11 and 1. But that's what you see here. Now, what I'm getting at is belief hopes. And hope causes, strengthens believers through so many things. Each one of these letters has a promise to the overcomer. And the English Standard Version, which I read most of the time, translates it conquerors. He who conquers. It is the word for that in English now is Nike. Some of you know this. But that's the Greek word that's translated overcomer or conqueror. And in each of these letters, there is a promise made to the one who overcomes. I will grant, I will give, I will make, I will come, etc. And then each of these promises is especially fitted to the needs of the audience of Christians at that place, what they're going through. Much like in this summer series, I'm the bread of life, I'm the light of the world, I'm the door, I'm the good shepherd, I'm the resurrection and the life, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, I'm the true vine, I'm the living one, I'm the first and the last, I'm the bright and morning star. Each of those speak to a need in human hearts. And we are invited to answer to that claim with belief. And we'll find that it's worth it. And I had a wonderful illustration, whole page here that I'm going to save for another time. I don't want you walking out in the middle of it. Any other prayer need especially that we need to have? And we'll try next week, by the way, we'll start a new series for the fall. David? All right. All right, David's sister, we want to pray for. Anyone else? Kelly, how's your mom doing? Very good, very good. Yes, ma'am.
Marty's been struggling the last 4 days with some chest pain.
All right, Marty's having trouble, so remember him in our prayers. Anybody else? All right, Paul, would you mind to stand there and lead us in our prayer tonight? Everybody pray with us, please.